Okay, tell you about Dory Zinkand. Dory's the principal of Tall Oaks Classical School in Newark, Delaware. And she has about 20 years of experience in homeschooling and schooling in classroom settings. She has a BS in education and psychology from Liberty University. What year, Liberty?
Actually, I just finished it up.
Is that right?
Up that one, yes.
And is working on a master's in education in the Great Books program at Harrison Middleton University. And lives in Maryland with her husband Bill and son Ben. Okay. Take it away.
All right.
Well, I guess I have to introduce myself then. Okay. This talk, the title says learning styles, but really I'm going to get into other ideas too of educational psychology and how we can be wise consumers of that with a biblical worldview. And I think it's easy to get led astray by these things sometimes, and we need to think carefully about them. So that's what I want to do. If you've, the Dewey Decimal System, I'm just one of those really systematic people, and so I have all my books Dewey Decimal, and there's the old Dewey Decimal that first started with sorting books, and then there's the newer version that keeps changing, through the years. They keep changing how the classifications work exactly and all. Well, the old one, all the psychology books would have been over in the 200s in the philosophy section. And now they're over in the science section. And it kind of begs the question. There's been an argument going on. There's handouts here. Kind of begs the question, is psychology, philosophy, or is it science? Well, there's sort of a little bit of a both going on, and there really is a changing view. So does it use the tools of science? Well, it does attempt to measure scientifically. They can only measure indirectly. Can't really see inside how someone is thinking or define scientifically how someone is feeling. Okay. You can't really control all the variables like you'd like to be able to do in good science. It makes heavy use of statistical evidence. The statistical evidence is kind of tricky because correlation doesn't always establish cause and effect. Just because things are together doesn't mean that one has caused the other or that there's anything much more than coincidence. In all sciences, data is evaluated based on what are our presuppositions. The less direct the evidence is, the more room there is for presuppositions to come in and affect the conclusions that are drawn. So think about that in terms of origins in science today. There's a whole lot of room for presuppositions in there, prior understandings in the indirect evidence that's being evaluated. Another important distinction, I think, is important for us to keep distinguished in our mind is the difference between a theory and a model. Models are very useful in science. They help us to organize our thinking. They don't necessarily claim to be true in a strict sense, but they help us to describe, explain, and predict phenomena. The Bohr model of the atom is something that's helped us all through the years to understand an atom, even though it's not really true in the sense in that that model that we look at looks anything like what an atom looks like. So models are legitimate tools and they're useful, but that's all they are. And in psychology, there's an awful lot of modeling. There's an awful lot of models. So psychologists are pushing for acceptance in the scientific community, and And this is pushing them to employ more scientific methods. I think as a field, it's improving in that regard, that methods being used now are far more scientific than they used to be. But it's still a little different there. So, and for us in Christian education, it is a useful tool. And I think we need to see it as a useful tool, and we need to just do it with the proper caution, that not everything said in the name of this science is necessarily valid. Some trends in educational psychology I want to go over. One is, you know, the No Child Left Behind. We hear a lot about how No Child Left Behind brought in standardized testing to a larger extent. But another thing it brought in was it wasn't going to give any grant money unless the program for which the grant was being received was research-based. It was trying to stop these trendy, whim-based programs that come in and out of education all the time. Those are being marginalized for ones that actually have some data backing them up. And that's done a lot to encourage better research in educational psychology. Now, one of the really interesting trends is that as they do this research and they actually correlate student achievement with different methods that are being used, is that they're discovering some new methods of teaching, like repeat reading and choral reading, where you have to, in order to increase fluency. Well, this is what they were doing in the one-room schoolhouse. You know, so a lot of the things that classical education has been touting as old tried and true methods that go back, you know, the millennia, are things that they're now discovering. And so, and the good part of that for us is that they're building curriculum and materials that are there that we can use some of it. And so that's the good thing about it. When there's a whole, and I'll talk about constructivism here in a minute, that there is one of the theories that's got a lot wrong with it, and yet there's some right with it too, and they've discovered some old methods too that are very useful in our math, and we use some of their materials for the teachers to use in math when planning their math lessons, because there's some helpful stuff in there. Let me talk about constructivism. Constructivism is a cognitive theory that says that the student constructs a mental framework of knowledge, and that they will take it too far. They'll take it with a sort of existentialist philosophy and say, well, they're constructing truth. You know, they construct truth in your mind, and you know. So I take it they're not constructing truth. They're constructing their understanding of the truth that exists outside of them. So that's a difference in philosophy there. You may have heard of scaffolding. Have you heard of a lot of educational materials with scaffolding in it? This comes from this idea. Vygotsky was a major psychologist that was working in the 50s, 60s, but a lot of his work is becoming very popular now. He talks about the zone of proximal development. Have we heard of that one? And it kind of says that, okay, this is what I can already do. So any tasks you ask me to do within here, I can easily do because I've accomplished mastery there. This is where I'd like to be. I can't do that yet. But in between there is this zone that he calls the zone of proximal development. And in that area, with a little help, with a little scaffolding, I can function in here with just a little bit of help. And so the teacher is to help the student in this area until they get to where they're comfortable up here. Okay? Nothing wrong with that. Vygotsky was a Marxist, but you know, it doesn't have anything to do with this. And so the same idea is consistent with the biblical epistemology that says, you know, you learn precept upon precept, and you know, it's not something new or that profound, but you'll find these things now in in curriculum materials, things that help you to guide students through that stage. And so those things are useful to us, even if we don't buy into the whole ball of wax. Take it to the other side. Gregory, if you were in my last talk, you know I tout this book, not this edition, though, because this one's The Unabridged Seven Laws of Teaching, John Milton Gregory. If you don't have this book, it's a very good book to get. Basics of pedagogy there. But he will talk about putting the student in a position of a discoverer. And this was written in the 1800s. So this is, he's talking about this, really. He's saying, put them in the position of discoverer. Take them from where they are to build to where they need to be, to discover the truth on their own as much as possible. Really the benefit for us is that there are teacher training materials, there's resources, there's curriculum materials out there that use some of these concepts. And if we're careful, they're very good for, you know, they're very good to be used in our schools and our homeschools. I want to talk now the main focus was learning style, so I want to talk about that in particular. There are several different models for learning styles. I'm going to go over one here as I finish up, but there are several. We need to first think about what learning styles are not. Okay, they're not a disability that has to be accommodated by teachers. I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm not visual. You know, still got to do that. Okay, so it's not a disability. It is not an excuse for poor performance. It's not an acceptable one. And it's not a fixed, unalterable personal characteristic. I think this is maybe the most important thing, is that these things change. They change with maturity. They change with experience. Now, what learning styles are, they're a description of the different pathways that all people use when learning and the different ways we all process information. We take in, yes. Yes. No. A description of the different pathways all people use when learning. The different ways that we process information. So it's both how we take the information in, either through hearing it, through seeing it, through reading it, through doing it, and the way that we process that information once we get it. Some people like to talk it out. Other people like to sit alone and think. You know, some people learn it best after they do something with it. So, you know, those are different learning styles. Okay. It's also a set of individual skills that a person has developed to use these pathways. You become a more skilled reader, a more skilled listener. And it's a set of preferences that a person has learning. Do you order the CD that you listen to in your car, or do you order the DVD to watch on your TV, or do you just get the book and read it? That's preference. And it probably has something to do with how you learn best. But I get the DVD. Okay. Or the book. Okay. All right. Now, how learning style models can be used by teachers. The most important thing probably is to develop instruction that conveys information through a well-balanced variety of learning pathways. The tendency of a teacher is to teach according to their own learning styles. What works best for them, they assume, is going to work best for their students. And so we need to be self-conscious about including the others in our teaching. It makes us much better teachers. Okay, and this, and it prevents a real mismatch, the student and the teacher as well, where the verbal teacher is teaching the visual kid. Another purpose is to develop the learning skills of the students. We want them to be able to use as wide a variety of learning pathways as possible. And I think this is a mistake that homeschooling parents need to be careful of. If you know your child has a certain way of learning that they like best, we tend to say, okay, well, then that's the way I'll teach them everything. But if you do that, they don't develop the other ways. So you need to have a goal of maybe teaching them the harder stuff the way they best learn, but also give them experience with the other ways to develop those skills, to make them better rounded. You know, you don't always have the choice between the book, the CD, or the DVD. You know, sometimes you have to go to a lecture in order to learn this material. And, you know, that's it. And they've got to learn how to do that. Sometimes you have to get your math book and sit down and work through problems in order to learn the math. And, you know, they need experience with that. They need to do that. So to best equip them with as good a balance as possible of learning styles, we need to teach them in different ways and give them experience. And the other is to challenge them to higher levels of thinking and understanding. Dr. Richard Felder, and he's the author of the Felder-Silverman learning style thing, which I'm going to go over here in a minute. He said, an objective of education should thus be to help students build their skills in both their preferred and less preferred modes of learning. Learning style models that categorize these modes provide good frameworks for designing instruction with a desired breadth. The goal is to make sure that the learning needs of the student in each model category are met at least part of the time. And this is referred to as teaching around the cycle. Okay. Some basic information about learning styles. One, there are several models that are used to describe and to assess learning styles. However, when they do studies as to how student achievement goes up when different ones are used, it's all the same. It does, when the teacher pays attention to learning style issues and designs instruction that's supposed to be well balanced, student achievement goes up, and it doesn't matter which model she used. So, you know, pick one you like, is what I'll say. I'll go over one with you, which I like, but, you know, they're different. And but it doesn't matter. Some talk about visual, tactile, you know, verbal, that kind of thing more than the one that I'm about to go over with you. It doesn't matter. Use whichever system, and it will increase achievement. No matter which learning pathways are well developed or preferred by a particular student, all students achieve more when the information is learned by more than one pathway. So all of us learn better when we can learn by more than one way. I tend to write on the board a lot when I teach, and hearing it, seeing it, those simple habits of you know, writing on the board, presenting outlines, that kind of thing, are helpful, and everybody learns better. Teachers do not need to assess or diagnose the learning styles of each student in order to develop instruction that's better balanced. You don't have to go give all your students learning styles tests. Okay. On the other hand, if you have a struggling student and you think that might be part of the problem, it might be worth looking at. But otherwise, just assume there's a variety out there. Teaching can become better balanced in terms of learning styles by forming some simple teaching habits, explaining the purpose of a lesson at the beginning of it and summarizing it at the end, writing keywords on the board, clearly organizing your materials, your written materials, by using subheadings, outlines, color coding, stuff. Providing time for students to reflect upon or discuss the lesson material, very important. Explaining why the lesson material matters and how it can be applied. Some of these will make more sense as we go over this method, this one model I have for you. Providing devices for memorizing facts. Some people really struggle with memorizing lists of information and that kind of thing. So there's lots of mnemonic devices out there you can use. I put everything to music. I can do the whole shorter catechism in a song if you want to hear. It's the only way I could learn it. Helping students see how information fits together to form the bigger picture. It's a lot of kids that need to see the big picture or they won't get the details. So we need to give them the big picture first sometimes. And providing hands-on opportunities to use the lesson in some way. Okay, and another important idea is this idea of metacognition. That's another big buzzword right now. But metacognition is really just thinking about your own thinking. And thinking about your thinking is more important than you might think. But you think? Talk to your students about problem solving. How did you solve that problem? You know, have them explain how they solved a problem. Explain to them what questions you're asking when you read a piece of literature. What questions are you asking yourself? As a mature reader, you're saying, well, what's going to happen next? Oh, is that important? Does that have to do, you know? Talk out loud, that kind of thing. As you solve a math problem, well, how'd you get that answer? You know? And talk about different ways there are to solve a math problem. There's not just one way to solve a math problem. So talk about the different methods that people use. How do you do mental math? So by talking about those things, they develop those skills. Okay. The one I want to go over, at the end of your notes that I gave you, is this balancing learning style differences. This is something I use with my training, my teachers at home. And I thought it would be helpful for you. And this is just one learning style model. Like I said before, there's more than one, and you can try to use others, but this will just give you familiarity with one, and it'll help you see how it ends up applying to teaching. So, This is the Felder-Silverman, the man I quoted earlier. Okay. This sets up similar to, some of you are familiar with Myers-Briggs, the personality test, where there's either you're this or that, you're this or that, and then, you know, on several different, and that's how this is set up. And some of this is kind of based on some of that. So the first category there is active versus reflective learning. Okay, when we learn actively, we learn by doing something with the information. When we learn reflectively, we're thinking it through. You're going to see a difference in discussions, where the first people that talk when you have a classroom discussion, they're your active. They're thinking out loud, and they're forming their thoughts as they're speaking them. Okay? The reflective people are like, wait a minute, leave me alone. Let me think. Got it. Okay. That's reflective. That's, you know, going off by yourself, considering the options and putting it together. Okay. So we have to leave time for both for our students, whether it's at home or whether it's in a classroom setting. Okay. You have to give time for those reflective learners to think things through. Journaling is a great way. But just, you know, give them time to think. Even just some pauses in your lecture is to let it soak in. Others, they need to do something with it, and they're not going to remember it until they do something with it. So we need to be sure that there's some application. There should be an application part of every lesson that you teach, something that they have to do with the information. Active learners need to think ahead a little more. Help them to do that. Help them make predictions. Help them say what's going to come next. Help them think of implications. Right. Okay, sensing versus intuitive. Sensing. I could diagnose myself as we go through this. I mean, I just see myself. All right. Sensing versus intuitive. Sensing learners, they like to learn facts, and they like to attend to details. And they really discourage me, because I can't do either one of those things. But intuitive learners are the ones that are far less concrete in their thinking, and they'll toss things around in their head and not be able to tell you how they did it. They're the ones who get the math problem right and then can't tell you how you did it, so you don't really believe them that they knew how to do it. But it's because they're manipulating symbolically and instead of words, and then it's hard to bring it back to that process and do it in words. So they're much more comfortable with abstractions, and they see relationships and applications. Oh, well, you could do this with that. You could do, you know. Okay. So very often the sensing kids will do better in traditional school, but you'll see, think about the classical method. It really does encourage more of this intuitive thinking, and it's good. And the goal would be to have our kids right down the middle, right? Being able to do both. Okay, so with our sensing learners, then they need help seeing abstractions, and the intuitive learners are going to need help memorizing things they've got to memorize and checking for details. How many have the math student that knows how to do it all and drops the minus sign every time? And there's hope for them in this world. Okay. Very often the intuitive, they know it better, but they just can't do it. Okay. Visual versus verbal. And this verbal doesn't mean in the sense of necessarily just listening to words, but it's words-based thinking versus visual thinking. You know, are you seeing a picture in your mind, or are the words flowing through? Visual learners best remember what they see in pictures, demonstrations, diagrams, and maps. Verbal learners best remember written and spoken explanations. Okay, but both do better when you do both. And this is one where drawing on the board, like I've talked about before, is key. Visual learners will be able to process written information better if you break it up for them, visually organize it for them. So that can be by using an outline, by using text boxes, by using color, whatever. By instead of presenting a whole block of written information, if you make the organization of that material evident by visually evident somehow, that's very helpful to your visual folks. Okay. Sequential versus global.
Could you mention a little bit of that verbal?
Okay, it was just a verbal learners learn through words. I mean, it's not necessarily words they hear, but words they read. Okay. So they benefit from opportunities to express in words what they've learned. So whether to write a summary, write a report, journaling again comes in for them. Okay, sequential versus global. Sequential learners build step by step in a logical progression. sequential learners usually do very well in school because schools tend to teach sequentially, which means they grow up and become teachers because school was such a great place for them. And they teach sequentially, and the cycle goes on. Okay, your classic underachiever, the Thomas Edison who flunks out of school and is a global learner. Okay, they're seeing the big picture. They don't want to take this step and this step and this step and this step if they don't know where they're going. And they don't understand, what are we doing? You know, we're walking down this dark hallway. Where, you know, where are we going? And they don't remember the details because they don't attach to anything. And it's only when they see the big picture that they're able to understand it, that they're able to retain it anyway. It's not that they can't understand it. There's no way to retain it. So your sequential teachers teach step by step to these global learners who are like, oh, you know, what is it? And it's very frustrating. The global learner loves pursuing rabbit trails. Why is this important? Why does that go with that? You know, going off, which frustrates the sequential kids, right? So you gotta balance that kind of thing. If you're familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, if you're familiar with Bloom's, we heard of that? Okay, that's the kind of levels of thinking, and there's six steps in it, and they really correlate very well with the grammar, logic, and rhetoric levels. So if you ever want ideas on activities and things to the type of learning activities to add to your class, if you go online and search for Bloom's taxonomy and find the sorts of questions you ask at the different levels of Bloom's, you can find it correlates very well to the trivium. So take the first two steps as grammar, the second two is logic, and the last two is rhetoric. So those higher level questions are the ones that these global learners really want to know. Global learners tend to leap to conclusions, and yet they're unable to explain how they got there. They just mentally juggled several factors in a symbolic way and can't put left brain words to their right brain wordless process they just went through. They are the first one to see connections, to understand the purpose, and all that. If they know those things, they can learn the material better. Professionally, these global thinkers tend to be very successful. It's necessary to be a visionary in order to break new ground. You need these, and so we want to develop these global thinking skills in our kids. But they do have a tough time in school sometimes. You know, how many groundbreaking sort of people you know of that dropped out of school before they finished because they just couldn't?
Could you clarify for me a little bit the difference between the global sequential learners and the sensing intuitive? Because it sounds like there's a lot of overlap here.
Yeah, and I think there is. I think what he was trying to describe with sensing and intuitive is more of the detail, the ability to see detail and to learn it and to soak it up. I think with a sequential, it's more speaking to the organization of the thought, whether you're logically building up from one to another or whether you're just leaping from one to another because somehow you see what's in between.
I understand. I've done some work with the Myers-Briggs types.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I'm trying to pull it in, just since they seem to be loosely based. Trying to pull this in, and it seems like that last section with the Myers-Briggs is more how you respond to outcomes and what your needs are for outcomes. But, and so I'm trying to plug that in here, and I'm just not, I'm an intuitive learner, and I'm not an intuitive learner.
He credits Myers-Briggs. I mean, he openly bases a lot of this on Myers-Briggs, so only he's trying to get it from learning. The difference I'm seeing is that in sensing versus intuitive, he's describing He's describing learning the actual information more. And in sequential versus global, he's describing processing more.
Okay.
How you're processing the thought, solving the problem.
So what,
but I mean, that's how I'm reading
it.
No, that's okay.
So what then would a sensing global learner look like?
Sequential versus global. Oh, you're combining.
I'm sensing Myers-Briggs stuff. So yeah. I'm plucking out, and I guess it's worth saying too that it's not a one or, it's a part of a spectrum.
Exactly. It is with this as well.
But what do you get when you've got a sensing? And you're also a global type of learner.
Yeah, I don't know that you would very often.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. Maybe it's the analogy.
Yeah. Like all models.
Why would not? What would be so distinctive that you wouldn't get a sensing with a global?
Because the sensing is more detail-oriented, that I think they would tend to want things presented sequentially. Rather than leaping around, but
I think he really only has three sets of categories and he's trying to Myers-Briggs.
Yeah, could be.
There's where I just made the intuitive leap.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, where they do occur and they are distinctive.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Help the global learners by stating early in a lesson what it is you're going to teach. And present the big picture. That's probably the most important thing. Start at the beginning and say where you're going. And then at the end, say it again for the sequential folks. So. All right. And again, rabbit trails, being able to take something off in a different direction, very energizing for your global learner. And very exciting for them to do that. And it's good for them. So. But you know, let me sum up a bit with this, and then we're going to have a lot of time for questions on this one, aren't we? 12, good, almost 20 minutes. All this stuff needs to be taken with a grain of salt. It needs to be used carefully. I think the most important thing is not to make it into an excuse for why we can't learn a certain thing or why a certain thing is difficult. Oh, you know, I hear the kids. Oh, well, see, I'm a visual learner, so, you know. Let's not allow it to become that. If you have trouble learning information visually, then work on that. You know, and if you have, because it's not unalterable. These things can be changed, they can be developed. You might still prefer to learn one way or another, but we need to develop our kids as learners and to develop them to use all the different styles. And like these descriptions, they're not one of them perfect or the different models that there are out there, but they're all useful. They're all useful for helping you to think through how you're teaching, how you're presenting the material. And the kind of experiences that you make sure your kids have. Especially in a homeschool setting, I think it's easy to get kind of into a mode. I know it was for me, for us to get into the mode of what we prefer and not get a wide enough breadth of experience in different learning pathways for our kids so that they can develop well when they... Throughout their lives, there's going to be all sorts of different learning situations. They're going to go to church and listen to sermons. They're going to go to lectures in college. They're going to have those professors we've all had that teach on something totally different in their lectures than what's in the textbook. And then what's in the textbook is what's in your test. And you need to be prepared for that. You know, they need to be able to handle that. So the lesson as we develop these students is to get them able to work in all those situations, as many situations as possible. Okay, we have more questions? Yes.
Okay, I understand that you want them to have the breadth of knowing all the different styles. Obviously, if you use the style that they prefer, they're going to retain that. Is there, clues as to what type of learner besides trial and error?
There are a number of tests available. This the one that I shared with you today, if you search on that, you'll find an online test for that.
What was it again?
Felder's, it's in your notes. It's Felder Silverman. He's at the University of North Carolina. He's actually a, I think, physics professor. See what I say about well-taught people. Yeah, this is, let me see.
I mean,
ncsu.edu/Felder dash public. I think that'll get you far enough. That one's probably better for older students than adults, that test. I don't know if he's got one for children on there.
I mean, the Myers-Briggs or something like this is easier for an adult to answer, you know, because you know, but when your children are like, you know, kindergarten, first, second grade.
Right, but they do have a number of models out there. It's just, if you go online and search, you'll find a number of the tests right on the internet. You can do them right on the internet and they'll give you the answer. There's one out of one of the professors in Liberty University, I can't remember his name now, has developed one. It's very comprehensive, but that's more for adults as well.
So you would just search under learning styles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There have been some studies, too, about the Myers-Briggs personality types and your learning preferences. And I just have a worksheet on all this stuff. One would prefer an Ignatian model and one an Augustinian model.
Right. Yeah, Myers-Briggs relates fairly closely to a lot of this, but it's more overall personality, whereas the learning style ones tend to focus on the way we learn and process information. So it's to just kind of take that one aspect of personality.
My last question, I promise.
That's okay. Got 20 minutes.
It's been theorized with the Myers-Briggs type indicators that certain types are not natural to children, that they develop later.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think we see playing out, too, with the classical education model. Is that something that has been addressed with the Felder Silverman?
Yeah.
Is that something that they've spoken on and
addressed? Yes, you'll find that younger children tend to be more visual. They get more verbal as they get older, as they get experience with it. You'll also find that in our day, because of video games, TV, whatever, that there's a certain ability to think sequentially that's being trained out of them, because you look at this, and then you look at this, and then pop, it changes, and the screen changes. And so the following a connected thought argument sequentially for an extended period of time is just something they don't have enough experience with. They're not listening to stories for a long time. They don't hear the whole conclusion. It's just very pop. Even when they do with a narrative that they're watching on television, this whole scene changes, the visual pop changes so much that they're not getting much experience. So that's something we need to make sure we're... I'm not saying we can't ever let kids do video games or anything, but when that's their world and that's what they have experience in, and they don't have experience following an extended argument, then there's a deficit there. And we see it in schools, and we see it in the attention span in schools. And in our school, even in this, you know, these are Christian people sending their kids to a Christian school, but we have to train that we start in kindergarten, training them to be able to listen for an extended time, to be able to follow an argument. They'll never make it through logic in middle school if they don't, you know, if they don't have that basis. So, yes.
There seems to be a lot of things to help a global learner. But as far as sequential, I mean, on my notes anyhow, unless I missed it, but as far as sequential and knowing like an outline and what else can we do to help us?
I tend to stay it's the other way around. I think most curriculum present materials sequentially.
So besides like an outline and things like that, you know, which to me seems boring.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything else to kind of
Well, the outline really helps the visual person to who's having trouble grappling with words as much, who tends to think in pictures. You can be a very articulate, smart person and tend to be more visual rather than verbal. I don't want to confuse those at all. The outlines and things will really help them so that they can consider this piece of the information and see, you know, visually see the organization.
But that's kind of it for a sequential line.
Well, no. I think timelines, right. And
I mean, just for me, because, like, to me that's, like, so dull and boring, but I have a job that's sequential.
Yeah. Well, you just think of how you organize. You have to impose the organization of the material on it as you present it. So organize it somehow. Do it step by step so they know this is the step, and this is the next step, this is the next step. That's what's really most helpful, is to impose the organization on them. The global learner doesn't need the organization. They don't need that.
Right. How do you reward the global learners in exams?
That's a good question, and I think I really appreciate that question, because the global learner isn't the one that's going to be able to spit back necessarily all the detail, but they are going to be able to make application, and I think that's a very important skill anyway, and we need to be developing it in these sequential learners. They need to do better at making application, so those, especially the rhetoric level. So you have this information, now you have to apply it to this problem, or you have to tell me how you'd explain this to somebody else, or, you know, so that kind of application problems and applying them to a project, having them put together, you know, the science fair projects, that's where your global learners shine, the history day projects. Those kind of things where they have to pull all the information together and make a big project out of it. Yes, ma'am.
Coming back to what he asked, how do you help a global learner understand, though, there are times when you have to go through the details and the sequential, and there's no way around it. And sometimes in math, you know, there are times when you'll have to do that. And what kind of things, I know you said to make that connection in the beginning, what the point of the lesson
mm-hmm.
is. So can you think of anything?
I would say mostly by making them explain the sequence, what it is. Okay. If they were going to explain it to somebody else, make them explain how to do the problem. And that forces them to put words to what they may have done without words.
Can I make a suggestion? I don't know.
Sure.
I have a lot of LD gifted kids. And so over the past, like, 30 years, I've learned a lot about, and I have a lot of global learners.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, like, research in learning disabilities has shown is a lot of the children do not actually use both brains together. There's, like, you have this layer of fat in between the brain, and the crossing doesn't occur in a lot of these children. And so they have different simple activities that they do to help them sometimes. And I think it could be applied to any learner. And one of them is just doing
figure eight
and exercises where you know, so they could cross the midline. Because if you're a global thinker, you're probably a right brain thinker, and they don't go over here to get the words and connect it, and that helps you do that. So if you learn these simple things and do it with them, they probably would hate it because it's boring, but it really works because I've been doing it with
you know, that's actually part of our kindergarten curriculum. I mean, one of the first thing the teacher will see early on, that some kids, when we're doing an eight, right, learning how to do an eight, some kids will, and they'll go with it. Because they can't cross. They can't cross over. Chalk on the sidewalk, they follow it. You know? And so that crossing the midline, it's it's surprising, but and then we do activities and things that force that. But we can spot the kids, and it's very, very often the learning disabled kids who can't do that. And this is a normal part of development, too. The young children, that kind of thing can develop, and so you help them develop it, but you develop in the physical as well as in the cognitive.
But what it actually does a lot is help the kids get the words. So lots of these global learners, it's hard getting the words. Mm-hmm. And I think if you do those activities, especially like in writing, a lot of these children are very smart, and then they can't get it on paper. And they're the kids that have to do this because that opens up getting it on paper. And so that's an idea. And also, like, exercise and core stuff, because it's the same thing. I'm just learning that from living a really hard life because of that.
Yeah.
Playing across has a right brain strategy. Very accessible.
What's the name again?
Diana Croft.
She
spoke at the chat conference last year.
She has a website.
And they're not expensive, and they're very easy to do in the home or in the school. And what was the other?
It's DianeCroft.com.
DianeCroft.com.
D-I-A-N-N-E. And I think that these things, these ideas could apply to helping all learners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what's most important about all this is that we use it to develop as better learners, as we develop our skills as learners to be more versatile in what we can do, in the kind of problems that we're asked to solve, the kind of situations we're asked to learn throughout our lives are going to vary quite a bit, and developing all these. It's best if you take one of these tests and you come right down the middle of the road. Are you sequential or global? Yes. Yeah. You know, that's the ideal. You know, we all see ourselves on one side or the other. But
the other thing I wanted to add was in the back of the Phonics Pathways book that a lot of homeschoolers use, there are a list of exercises that force the child across the midline. And these same exercises that we did at home, we had developmental optometrist who wanted to do those same exact exercise for $125 an hour. And I thought, in the back of my $20 book.
In fact, our the developmental optometrist that works in our area recommends that book.
Yeah.
What's
the name of the
book? Phonics Pathways.
That is $20 from Rainbow Resource.
Yeah.
All you need is a half an empty space and
basically. Yeah, you know, even the simple put your right hand on your left ear sort of exercise is hard for kids who aren't crossing over very well. They just can't, you know, and they've got to put words to that physical thing of putting the right hand on the left ear. And
so, Jim, actually, all the phys ed that is, it starts the day so much better if you do it.
Interesting. Okay. Yes?
A few words on the books you have.
Oh, yeah. Some of these are actually for another class, but there's another course. But this one I talked about, John Milton Gregory, Universe Next Door. You familiar with this one? This is a basic worldview book. James Sire is a Christian. He talks about the elements of a worldview. What questions every worldview answers, and then he goes through several of them here. Let's see, he goes through Christian theism, deism, naturalism, nihilism, existentialism. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble today. Eastern pantheistic monism and New Age and postmodernism are all in here. He calls it a basic worldview catalog. Great book. He has a follow-up. I've got it. There's somewhere too. There it is. How to Read Slowly. And in this book, you're finding all those worldviews in the authors. That's what he's helping you to do. another one. This is another good one. How to Read a Book, Mortimer Adler. Get that first. This is a good one to read second. Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. We know that one from that's sort of the Classical Christian Education Bible. Well-Trained Mind and also the Well-Educated Mind. This one is for classical education at home. The other one, the Well-Educated Mind, is really for your own education. This is one for your children. Are they? Oh, okay. That's Susan Wise Bauer and Jesse Wise. Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. This book I highly recommend. This is Total Truth, Nancy Piercy. This is another worldview, basic, more of a philosophy book. She also wrote with Chuck Colson, How Shall We Then Live, or the sequel to that. Schaefer's was How Shall We Then Live, and it was How Now Shall We Live, or something like that. But she wrote that with Colson, and this one's on her own. I really appreciate this book. Then this one will help you understand errors in your own thinking that we accept because of the time we live in, and we accept without thinking. It's a very challenging book. It's worth reading. Piercy, P-E-A-R-C-E-Y, Nancy. Okay. Got any other questions? That was fun. Thank you.